Former South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis is a Republican who represented the 4th House District for 12 years before turning his attention to fighting climate change, which he says can be accomplished with conservative principles. Mr. Inglis is now the executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative based at George Mason University. He is in the region for a number of speaking engagements.
We believe that conservatives have shrunk in science denial because they haven't heard a solution that fits with their values yet. What they've heard is this can take a bigger government and probably UN involvement and a one-world government and all of these kind of things that conservatives really don't cotton to. And so what we live to show them at republican.org is it really it takes a smaller government. It takes a simple price on carbon dioxide through a carbon tax. That's paired with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in taxes or a dividend of all that money back and an application of the tax at the borders, and so that the whole world then gets in on the deal. And so when conservatives hear that with high-octane conservative language, like the language that, say, Milton Friedman, one of the fathers of modern conservatism would have used, then they can understand it and they can embrace it.
You mentioned a carbon tax. There are those who say carbon shouldn't be taxed. It should be eliminated.
Yeah. I think the thing that's interesting is in the economics profession, there's amazing consensus about a carbon tax, that it's the most efficient way to deal with the problem of climate change. Actually, more consensus even than there is in the scientific community about climate change itself, although there is amazing consensus about that as well. But it's really hard to find an economist who would disagree with the idea of taxing carbon dioxide. And that's why, as I was saying earlier, it really is possible to bring left and right together here, because whether you're an economist on the right or an economist on the left, you probably come to the conclusion that a carbon tax is the most efficient way to deal with climate change.
How would most people pay a carbon tax? Would we pay more at the gas pump? Would people who heat their home with home heating oil have to pay more? How would we actually pay that carbon tax in our everyday lives?
Presumably, it would be an upstream application of the tax. So at the mine, at the pipeline. The good news about that is there are only about 2,000 companies that either mine coal or put stuff in a pipeline. So it'd be a very small job for the IRS. But yes, downstream in that pipeline and from the mine, we'd all pay the truer cost of energy. Now, of course, that doesn't sound very attractive yet, right? I mean, we're talking about the price of everything going up. But it's not going up artificially. It's going up to the true cost, the fully accountable cost. And then you pair that carbon tax with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in taxes, existing taxes, or a dividend of the carbon tax money back to the citizenry. So now we have got money in our pockets to pay these truer cost of energies. At that point, we start choosing the new energies, the ones that don't have the emissions, the ones that the free enterprise system can innovate and deliver to us.
You talk about fickle tax incentives and something we shouldn't be dealing with, fickle tax incentives. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, the $7,500 electric car credit, the production tax credit for wind that expires, I guess, in 3 years now. They faced a near-death experience 2 years ago, the wind industry did. The investment tax credit for solar. These are tax credits that have expiration dates attached to them. And so people in those industries face a cliff every time they come to the expiration dates. And so rather than having those near-death experiences, we think what we should have is just a stable tax regime that says, here's the deal. The price of carbon dioxide is going to steadily rise. And we see that in the carbon tax. And you're getting a larger paycheck because we've cut income taxes or we've cut payroll taxes. Or here's a dividend check of that tax revenue back to you, the carbon tax revenue back to you. So you've got money in your pocket to innovate, but you do see the fact that the price of carbon dioxide is going to steadily rise. And that is the key to innovation.
Should the United States have withdrawn from the Paris Accord?
No, it's really a huge mistake, we think, at republican.org, because, Paris established a will, and that's a very important thing in solving a problem, is deciding you got the will to solve it. Of course, it didn't establish a way, but Still, we would far prefer for the United States to be leading this rather than sniveling on the sidelines. It's not where I think my country should be, is sniveling on the sidelines, saying that the game wasn't fair for us or something.
Yeah, there are some who would suggest that, okay, we do our part, but China gets off. They grow economically while our economy is stagnated by this. Is that a true accusation?
Yes, if the carbon tax is done just here and not worldwide. So it's very important to use the market access power of the United States. In other words, access to the market. Use that carrot in order to draw the rest of the world into the same kind of pricing of carbon dioxide. So what that means is we would apply this tax, this carbon tax, at the border, collect it on goods from countries that don't have the same price on carbon dioxide. We expect China would challenge that in the World Trade Organization, saying that it's an impermissible tariff. We think they lose that case in the WTO based on precedents in the chemical industry. And 24 hours after they've lost, because as you know, they get an amazing way of reaching consensus in China, they would have the same price on carbon dioxide because they're paying a tax on entry into an American port that's going to Washington. The tax is headed to Washington. If they had just had that tax in China, the tax money would have been going to Beijing. And so 24 hours later, they got the same price on carbon dioxide. Then the whole world follows. And then we don't have the leakage problem. We don't have manufacturers picking up from New York or South Carolina or wherever and going to China, where they would emit more than they're emitting here. So we'd lose not just jobs, we'd lose the race, and we believe it is a race to reduce emissions.
What about coal? You come from the South, not necessarily coal country in South Carolina, but what is the future of coal? Is there a future, or should those mines be closed down and we move on?
There's a future for coal if there's a way to sequester CO2. I was on the science committee, even though I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you that I hope it works, but I'm not aware of things that are commercial yet. But there are people working on it. Hopefully it'll work. But if that were to happen, then there's a future for coal. Otherwise, this supposed war on coal that President Trump blames President Obama for has nothing to do really with anything that President Obama did. It has to do with fracking. And because fracking expanded the supply of natural gas and brought down the price of natural gas, for example, 6 coal-fired plants in South Carolina converted or in the process of converting to natural gas from coal. So they're no longer customers of Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Montana. They're customers now of Texas. That's happening all across the country. That was the war on coal. It has to do with innovation in fracking.
Former South Carolina Republican Congressman Bob Inglis is in the region for a number of speaking engagements on solving climate change with conservative principles. He is the executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative based at George Mason University.